Hi everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hi, everyone. My name is Brianna Contreras, and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this latest episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite's Meet the Board podcast series, Senior Editor of MHE Peter Werwein and I spoke with MHE Editorial Advisory Board member Doug Chayet. Chayet is President of Value Evolutions and Chairman of the American Association of Integrated Healthcare Delivery Systems. In this conversation, we were able to learn more about the loyal board member and his background in healthcare toward his managed care career, and were able to hear his thoughts on particular topics such as value-based care, ACOs, and more. Hello, Doug. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us today for an episode of Tuning the C-Suites or MHE Meet the Board series. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
No problem. So to get started, just so our listeners and readers can, you know, get to learn more about you and our board members, can you just share a little bit about your background, maybe how you got into healthcare, and how long you've been on MHE's editorial advisory board?
Sure. Yeah. So actually, I've been in healthcare about 35 years. I got into it originally because I had this notion that I wanted to be a hospital administrator, and that sounded like an interesting thing to do because I thought there would be a lot of variety in the job and I'd be able to deal with all sorts of professionals, physicians, and attorneys, and so forth. And, you know, did that for a while. And lo and behold, I don't know, five, six years later, this thing called managed care became a movement. And I jumped into that. And before I knew it, I was a fairly young guy, and I had been in the managed care industry for 10 years. When the industry itself was only about 10 years old. And you know, I ended up spending the next 20 years or so representing payers and providers. And I kept flipping sides so that I could continue to sort of refresh my lens. And you know, down the road, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, actually broaden that view a little bit and became more and more involved in the purchaser side of things. So, you know, what it's like to be a large self-funded employer and have these value-based programs and different payer type offerings, you know, put in front of you. And, you know, so again, it's really been a pretty interesting ride over the past couple of decades.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Now, if you can share, because I believe you did briefly mention prior to this conversation, you've been with the board for a while with MHE. And as you said, you know, you were in the kind of the startup of managed care. You know, you got to see from where it began in healthcare, and you're now where it is today. You know, you've seen it kind of, you know, change and evolve. So if you can just maybe briefly share, you know, what you've seen, at least how you've seen MHE grow, I guess, in your time here, and maybe just how managed care itself has evolved.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My first exposure to managed care, you know, came back, I guess started actually back in the 1980s. And it came about because I accepted a position with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida. And I had the dubious task of being on this team who would knock on the doors of hospital administrators and introduce the notion of actually paying the hospitals less than what they charged, which was a very unfamiliar concept because up until then, they basically got paid whatever they would bill. And that was the way it worked. And so I had a number of doors slammed in my face. And, you know, for a long time, it was about rates, it was about discounts, it was about price. And then it became really more about care management and, you know, how do we do that effectively? Do we micromanage? Do we use things that we, you know, today think of as care management or disease management? Or do we push risk on to providers? And so I actually started my career and actually spent a large portion of the first half of my career in what we refer to today as risk agreements. So one of my early jobs when I left Blue Cross was to work for a large health plan that was actually owned by three multi-specialty physician groups. And the way they apportioned the risk, because they also owned a health plan, was to basically capitate these three medical groups based on their attributed patient populations. And look, you know, 30 years ahead, we're doing the same thing. CMS is doing the same thing. And in some respects, I think, you know, as an industry, we've evolved. In other respects, it's very much the same. I mean, I could probably take out some old 35 millimeter slides that I used to use in presentations in 1992, and they would still be relevant. Of course, I'd probably have a hard time finding a slide projector, you know, to actually show them. But if I could turn those into PowerPoint slides, they would still work for the vast majority of audiences today because people would keep dabbling and dabbling. And there has been sort of a lack of engagement, which hopefully, you know, with initiatives like direct contracting, you know, we'll see more of a push in that direction. But I think MHE in particular has done an amazing job keeping up with things because, you know, as topics have changed and as emphasis has changed, you know, so has the publication. I mean, I was around when, you know, it seems like every story was about companies like Vicor or Med Partners or PHOs or, you know, early stage IPAs. And now here you are. And, you know, you talk about specialty pharmacy, which wasn't even a thing, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And so you guys have done a really good job, I think, staying relevant. And I also just have always loved the variety of the topics that you guys cover in your publications because it isn't written for one specific audience. You know, it pulls people in. Really, anybody who's involved in progressive healthcare delivery, and I think that's a terrific thing.
Yeah, Doug, this is Peter Werlwein. Yeah, I think it's sort of interesting that you know, managed care, which sort of got started as you referenced, as something that insurance companies were doing. Now everybody seems to have a hand in, partly because risk has been transferred to providers. You mentioned dabbling. Are you at all frustrated that we are, in some sense, still dabbling in managed care? Or maybe I should put it more precisely, that we are still dabbling in managing care.
Yeah, definitely, because I think in some ways we've actually gone backwards. You know, early on, there was a lot of focus on HMOs. And as most people know, primary care gatekeeping was a central function to that. And you know, I think that was actually a good thing because you took somebody who was a generalist, who knew a little bit about a lot of things, who you would think would not be, you know, overly biased, you know, from a specialty or a hospital perspective. And you said, look, we want you to be the quarterback. We want you to try to insist on a degree of accountability here, and we want to pay you a little bit more so that you will be the principal manager for this patient. And that was a concept that I think was a good one. But, you know, the pushback that you got at that time was that people didn't want to be managed. And that's just human nature. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, just even as a patient saying, I don't want to have to get a referral from my doctor just to go get my mole checked at a dermatologist. I don't want to get a referral if I think I need, you know, something else done. I'm a smart person. I'm not going to go use these services if I don't have to. And so you got this pushback, and then unions got involved and they pushed back. And next thing you know, most markets went from being HMO centric to PPO centric. And when you did, when that happened, it really struck a blow to risk type arrangements, because now you couldn't easily determine which patients were attached to which primary care physicians, because they didn't have to choose a primary care physician. And now you had to come up with, you know, complex attribution logarithms, methodologies. And then what happened is that all of these patients who went from being in HMOs to PPOs, they then moved from being in insured PPOs to self-funded PPOs. And then, you know, you get to a point where a company like Cigna, who used to be a real insurance company, now is really more of an administrator of administrative services to large self-funded companies. And if I'm not mistaken, 80% of their business is self-funded employers. And so really it's the employers who are taking the insurance risk. And Cigna is providing a lot of the service functions and the administrative functions. And you know, they contract with companies to help out with things like wellness. But again, the notion of who's taking the insurance risk has changed dramatically, you know, since the 90s or the early 2000s. And so that's a lot of dynamics to deal with. And if you're a hospital or a doctor, you have to keep taking all of this into consideration as you determine how far you want to go along that managed care continuum. And I think as a result, and this is a long way of answering your question, you ended up with a lot of sideliners, you know, health systems and physician groups who have decided essentially to dabble in these things just to make sure that if somebody ever turned the switch on and you had to be really good at this tomorrow, that you wouldn't be starting from scratch. But you didn't want to be so good that you actually reduced care so much that you lost your own income in the process. And I think that's kind of where we are today still.
So what do you think of the ACO as a vessel, as a instrument for managing care, which I guess these days we're filing under the heading of a value-based care?
Yeah, I definitely support ACOs. I wish we had more organizations who were not just experimenting with it. And I think, you know, part of the challenge here is that when the organization that the ACO is dealing with is the government can change the rules. So it's not a negotiated arrangement like it would be with an Aetna or a Cigna or a Blue Cross plan. So CMS comes out and they'll say, okay, we have this new initiative. This is the program. This is how it works. And then you then as the ACO get to say, okay, yes, I want to do that or no, I don't. But there isn't any negotiation, so to speak. You can't come up with a better deal than what's offered. It really ends up being more of a take it or leave it. And so that makes it difficult. And I think the other thing that makes it difficult today, and it's been like this for about 10 years now, is that the ACO programs are really more like a cafeteria plan, in that CMS has tried so many different options that now you have different organizations who are in different programs, but it's unclear as to what the final destination looks like. And that makes it tough, because absent that, You don't know what you need to look like when you grow up. And I think that makes it hard. And so what happens is that providers tend to sort of jump into these programs, the ones that have nominal risk. They give it a go for whatever the minimum period is, usually 3 years. And if they make money, they re-up unless they have to take a lot more risk. If they lose money, they try to figure out why they lost money. But again, remember, they're getting data in a lag format. And so 18 months hence, they're looking at how they did 18 months prior. And then they have to sort of reconcile why this happened, which doctors or which hospitals were responsible. Are they still practicing the way they did, are they still even working here? And so it really becomes kind of a crapshoot. And I think the other sort of flaw, and this is an inherent flaw, is that it isn't sort of commonly known who's doing well and who's not doing well. It's true that the performance in these organizations is publicly available. And I've actually tried, you know, through various articles and blogs, I've tried to increase awareness. But the average consumer, the average patient, even the average payer doesn't really keep track of how different health systems or different ACOs are doing in these Medicare arrangements. It's really just the ACOs who keep track of how they're doing. And so the danger of that, or I guess, you know, the shortcoming is that normally providers really change when there's some sort of a potential reputational impact. And if their reputations aren't being challenged because they're underperforming, it's hard to get them motivated to do more. Clearly you have the financial motivation, but the reputational piece is always huge, you know, when it comes to doctors in particular.
Yeah. And I think, of course, ACOs sort of operate in the background, and there isn't great public, you know, people in the biz are aware of them, but not the general public. I that's an interesting point you raise about sort of the CMS setting the rules, and it's a take it or leave it option for the providers. But what about the role of the private insurers here? And is it because, as you mentioned, they've become sort of administrators rather than true payers or insurers, that they aren't sort of exercising more influence in this area? It seems that all the discussion, at least, you know, public discussion has been about CMS programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, the results of payer-specific performance are not public knowledge, you know, so and you know, I think even more importantly, if you're a customer of a large payer, you may not even know what the impact of the program is on your own employee base. Because many times, you know, these are national accounts. And so if you're a company like Walmart and you have employees in 50 states, or let's say you're even a smaller national account and you have employees in 6 states, that means, you know, you may be using Aetna in all 6 markets. You may have chosen to use Aetna in 2 of the markets and Cigna in 3 of them and Blue Cross in 1 of them. And so how do you compare apples to apples? And, you know, when one of these payers comes out and they have these wonderful sound bites and they say, look, you know, we now have 80% of our providers participating in at least one of our value-based programs, that's great. I mean, that means that they've actually developed these programs and they have rolled these programs out, and either through an opt-in process or through a contractual arrangement, there are doctors and hospitals who have at least theoretically put up some percentage of their reimbursement. But without the details, it's really very difficult to know how impactful these programs are. And I think You know, one of the things I've picked up in dealing with my clients who are large employers is that they don't really care about programs at this point. They're looking for solutions. And the solutions means that there is a tangible result. And if it's a specialty specific program, they really want to understand how the pieces all fit together. And if it's more of a global type program, like an ACO model, where you have all sorts of specialties and all sorts of providers, then, you know, what's the target? What was my historic baseline? And what is it now in terms of post-program performance? And I think, most payers have struggled in capturing that information in a credible way. And some of the more insightful and more progressive employers are challenging that now. And some of them have actually gotten to the point where they're looking for alternatives. They're looking at employer standalone initiatives, either where they go directly to providers or they use some middleman to help them negotiate agreements and do things that are solutions that are custom made for them, you know, versus having them latch on to a national program that may be a great fit for Nashville, but may not be a great fit for Kansas City.
So when you're talking about employers looking for their own solutions, are you talking about some version of direct contracting with a local healthcare system? Is that what you are referencing there?
Sometimes that's the solution. Sometimes it's having a direct deal with vendors who are directly involved in serving as an intermediary with providers. So it could be that you're interested in making sure that your patients really understand how to better navigate the health system if they have, a musculoskeletal problem, right? And so in addition to having John Doe go see Dr. Smith, they will sometimes contract with a third party who says, let me help you manage this patient. Or if it's patient direct, Mr. Smith, let me help you manage this process with Dr. Jones. And there are companies who do that. One of the biggest companies who I think has made a real name for themselves in terms of serving as these intermediaries is Accolade. You know, Accolade has done really well. They've had phenomenal success in this space, basically providing services to a large extent that most folks would expect the health insurers to provide, except some of their clients actually think they do it better, and so they contract with this company. And so they're certainly not the only example, but that's really what I mean in terms of just going direct for a solution.
That's fascinating. It seems like just as healthcare has gotten more and more specialized with the provision of healthcare, that on the payer, insurer, managed care side, you get a sort of fracturing into specialists and jobbing out things to third parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know what it is, Peter? I think part of it is that for a while, the industry kind of went in the wrong direction when they were developing these value-based programs, because rather than set targets around outcomes, a lot of the metrics that were being used in these programs were check-the-box metrics. So rather than say, if you improve your performance, this is what you will get, they were rewarding providers for doing a certain test or for completing a survey. Those are the check-the-box type metrics that I'm referring to. And I think all this really happening, if you really want to encapsulate this, it's the purchasers who are saying, I don't want to pay for activity. I don't want to pay for effort. I want to pay for results. And for the most part, that's what's missing from these programs. And I think part two of that need is that they don't want to pay for national results. They want to pay for results that are specific to their employer group. So again, if you're a company like PepsiCo or Home Depot, and if your third-party administrator has a value-based program that saved all of its customers collectively $200 million last year, that's nice to know. But if you're the head of benefits for Home Depot, what you want to know is how much it saved Home Depot last year. And that's what the heads of benefits are asking for. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to comment when somebody says, are these programs working or not? Because I think they're working for some, but I'm not sure they have benefited everyone to the extent it was expected that they would.
And when the HR person at a large company asks that question, are the insurers or the I don't know what to call them these days, the administrators, are they even able to answer that question, or is the data not sort of organized that way so that HR benefits person gets a kind of non-answer?
You know, I've seen it both ways. I have seen some examples of some really impressive reports that have been produced by payer partners. And I've seen others who are not able to really back it up. And typically what you see in those examples is the employer going back to the payer saying, look, if you can't show me that this program that I funded, at least in part, is producing a positive return, then I want some sort of a financial guarantee on this. And these rate guarantees have become more and more prevalent in the industry. And they won't necessarily say, okay, this program saved me X. What the payer will end up doing, and again, this is not, I wouldn't call it commonplace, but it is happening, is that the payer will say, look, I will guarantee you that your cost of healthcare from last year to this year, apples to apples, does not increase more than X. And they will essentially put their money where their mouth is in terms of their ability to effectively control costs. So it's really an indirect way of making the payer produce results through these value-based agreements, or even more fundamentally, just, you know, limiting the amount of rate increases that they're giving to the providers. Because it isn't, you know, when a payer says, I'm going to give you a guarantee, they're not necessarily saying that I'm going to guarantee the results of my value-based program. They're guaranteeing cost containment through any number of mechanisms. Could be, you know, superior medical management. It could be better negotiated rates, or it could be the combination of the two through value-based care, because they've essentially been effective in shifting that accountability from the insurer, from the purchaser, to the providers.
Now, let's not forget the end user.
Yeah,
the member or the patient here. So, how are the employees and the public and people experiencing all this? Is surprise billing a manifestation of the current state of affairs of managed care to some extent? If they're guaranteeing a rate, is that partly as a result of a closed network and a bill that the member ends up having to shoulder?
It's hard to say. I mean, I, you know, going back to one of your earlier questions, I think this is another area where we just haven't grown the way we probably should have grown over the past 10 to 20 years. And I'm talking about patient engagement, you know, patient understanding. And I think the challenge here is that, you know, as patients or as purchasers, and it's the same thing in retail. I mean, we want it all if we can get it, right? But if we can't get it, you know, how do we know we're getting a good deal? And I think we struggle with this all the time, whether we're looking for a new television or we're looking for a new car. And, you know, no matter how hard you look, it's very difficult to find apples to apples comparisons. And I think that's still missing in the healthcare space. I also don't think the payers have gone as far as they could have with respect to engaging patients. And you know, normally the way to do that is through benefit plan design. So if you have to pay a larger percentage than you did yesterday, that tends to make, you know, make you think about where you go and when you get it. When it doesn't affect you personally, it's not as big of a consideration. I read a blog the other day, and this isn't anything new, but I think it illustrates the point. If you go to a hospital and you get an MRI, and the hospital's contracted rate for that MRI is $2,500, and let's say you have to pay 20% of that on your plan, you're paying a $500 copay for this $2,500 procedure. There probably was a freestanding diagnostic site between you and that hospital where you could have gone and purchased that MRI by paying cash and gotten that same test for $300. And the question is, why didn't you do that? Because the insurance company would not have incurred the claim, and your out of pocket actually would have been $200 less than if you had gone to the hospital. And I think, you know, the obvious answer is because, well, gee, I didn't know. And there's so many of those examples out there. And what we tend to see is more of a band-aid approach in the industry. I mean, having worked for health systems, I've seen patient letters come in for years and years and years where somebody complains about this. And invariably, these bills get adjusted in the favor of the patient. But the health system and the payers all know that it's easier to adjust these on a one-off basis than to actually change a policy or to change a benefit plan design. And so they do that.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.